Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, hey, welcome to Page Break. I'm your host, Brian McClellan, coming to you on a rainy summer morning in the mountains of Utah. Couple quick announcements. As I've been beating into your heads, my new epic fantasy, In the Shadow of Lightning, is out in just 1 week from release of this episode. Pre-orders are a huge part of the ultimate success of a book, so if you're planning to pick it up early and can do so, I'd be very grateful if you did. If, however, you'd like to see me in person, I'll be signing at the Barnes & Noble in Orem, Utah on June 21st, the Tattered Cover in Westminster, Colorado on June 24th, the Barnes & Noble in Mentor, Ohio on June 25th, and the King's English in Salt Lake City, Utah on June 29th. Events are free, so do consider buying your book directly from the store. I look forward to seeing you there. A couple warnings regarding this episode. There is quite a lot of swearing, as well as an in-depth discussion of severe mental health issues. If either of those things puts you off in any way, maybe skip this week. Now, on with the show. My guest this week is epic fantasy author Scott Lynch. Scott is the author of the critically acclaimed and best-selling Lies of Locke Lamora and the follow-ups Red Seas Under Red Skies and The Republic of Thieves. Scott and I talk about the double-edged nature of being a writer during the pandemic, and the need to attend to your physical health, even when you don't want to. We also discuss Scott's ongoing battle with mental health issues and how they've affected his career, both publicly and privately. Finally, Scott chats about where he's at with his writing and what fans can hope to expect from him in the near future. Enjoy my conversation with Scott Lynch. Scott, how have you been doing lately?
Life has been interesting lately.
Yeah?
In good ways and bad ways. I mean, I'm in the same boat as, you know, a lot of people in terms of, you know, when you get that question, you know, so how have you been lately? How have the last couple of years been? You just, you know, your eyes kind of start spinning and you just start joker laughing and it's like, where does one even begin?
Right. Can I put an ice pick into my own eye?
Yes. You know, I hope my email finds you well. Well, as a matter of fact, it finds me living in interesting times. You know what? Interesting times suck ass. And you know, no, we're okay. We're comfy, we're safe. Our families are mostly comfortable and safe. You know, we don't have any real complaints. And we work in a strangely popular luxury goods market, you know, telling bespoke lies to people that has sustained us through the pandemic in a way that, you know, some industries have not been sustained. So I'm a little more frazzled than I might otherwise be. But, you know, honestly, I'm doing OK.
Right. It's kind of weird being in publishing right now, because at least as far as I've heard, it sounds like the last couple of years has been harder to break into publishing, but really good for people with backlists.
I mean, you know, the plural of anecdote is not data, and I can only give you, you know, and I know I'm opening a can of worms. You know, anytime you reveal what your own personal experience is, everyone who does not have that personal experience, you know, takes it as an attack upon themselves. But, you know, possibly I'm just being very harsh, but you've met the internet. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I unfortunately have met the internet.
No, you know, I mean, publishing is an ongoing trash fire maintained by some of the best and most well-intentioned people on earth. You know, and I love it and it's where I want to be, but it has a lot of issues, you know, structurally and specifically. And, you know, a lot of people working in production editorial in recent months have expressed their dissatisfaction by punching the, you know, the eject button and doing so in public, just because, you know, the author experience is only one side of things. There are an awful lot of other people involved in bringing books to market. And, you know, the any benefit of the last couple of years has not been very evenly distributed. And the experiences have been different from publishing house to publishing house. I have friends at a fairly significant New York publisher who shall remain anonymous. And in the very earliest days of the pandemic, the word that came down from their corporate overlords was, we expect that everybody's going to be furloughed. And, they basically entered into a giant handshake bargain that everybody would be furloughed to work from home when they could. And everybody could expect, that this would diminish their salaries, and they would all sort of take a hit together to keep the company afloat. And it was literally like 6 or 7 weeks later that corporate came back to them and said, no. Furloughs are canceled. We need everyone back in the saddle remotely. And we're paying you for the time that we already said we were going to furlough you. And it's that latter that kind of indicates just how urgent this was. Like, pay you money you already agreed not to take? Holy shit, this must be important. So, they were drafted back into a much busier situation than they had expected. And, speaking just personally, it's been very odd. I can tell you that roughly speaking, my annual book sales, which, were not exactly shabby prior to 2020, have literally doubled in the last 2 years. I'm at twice my usual annual volume in terms of royalties, reprints, et cetera, et cetera. And, that's very nice for me. I wish it was under different circumstances.
Right. I've had a fairly similar experience in terms of, the kind of, I haven't put out a Powder Mage book in 3 years now. And I have pretty strong expectations of that, of the royalties, diminishing as they do. And they went up, and then they continued to go up. And that was a very weird experience. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm not going to complain. But like you said, yeah, I wish it was under different circumstances.
Yeah. And, I do recognize that, a lot of the usual, accoutrement, a lot of the usual foo-fara of releasing a book, like, this is a really hard time to be a debut author, or to be a neophyte author, or to be attempting to, pull off some kind of career pivot, because for roughly 2 years, like, the usual shtick just did not apply. And all those things that you might be looking forward to with various degrees of anticipation, the parties, the book launches, the releases, you have an entire crop of new releases that just did not get that usual sort of even minimal social support and interaction, that didn't get those rites of passage. It's like high school kids who couldn't have graduation ceremonies, who couldn't have proms. It's certainly not worth risking your life over. It's certainly reasonable to curtail those activities for a while, but it's still, it stings, yeah. And I feel a great deal of sympathy.
Yeah. Yeah. That losing out on all of those various things. I mean, in our industry, it would just be, losing out on that, getting a local bookstore to have a little launch for you, even if it's a small one, that's part of kind of your debut sort of thing, right? That's what I did. Like, you had all family and friends come and came to the library, to the extra room and everything. And, that kind of thing, that's gotta suck to lose out on that.
Yeah, my first big hometown signing back in 2006, aka the cross between a family reunion and a high school reunion,
right?
But yes, it's still one of the perks of a very uncertain and high stress job that, at least you're gonna get to have these little things. You're gonna get to have your debut. You're gonna get to be a debutante. And you're going to have a spotlight, shown upon you, even if it's just for a few moments, even if it's just in a little setting. And, that's the churn that brings new authors into, the society of literature in general, that brings them into, the big swirling mess that we call the industry and the community. And, it sucks to have that shut off. And to have everybody kind of have to flail about, what goes in place of that when that can't happen.
Yeah, no, it's I think obviously there's various levels of people that have wanted or been able to kind of remain secluded, right, the last couple of years. And, you know, like for me personally, I'm on the very, very far end because I'm immunocompromised and I work from home. And so it's no big deal. And I spent something like, I think there were 14 months straight where I didn't see anyone but my wife.
Oh, yeah.
Which was horrifying, but I could do it, right? And
well, yeah, you know, I mean, roughly in the same boat, you know, we both work from home. We don't have any children. You know, I live in Massachusetts and my family lives in Minnesota. I mean, not being able to jump out and see them, you know, at the usual times of the year, you know, has been a real bitch.
Yeah.
That's the part that sucked. But you know what? I mean, I've been practicing to live through a pandemic for most of my adult life. I do very well in solitude. In many respects, I'm a very, you know, typical writer in that I'm a weird little mushroom person who likes living behind his keyboard. You know, so we're very, very adept at, you know, being exiles from society here. But it's still unhealthy and it's still, you know, oppressive to have the possibility of, you know, desired engagement, you know, removed from you. And you don't really notice it until it's gone. And, you know, and we've been very careful and we've been, you know, very secluded and we've taken this very, very seriously. But and you know, the thing is that, as you say, you know, we're relatively lucky in that we're able to do that. We're able to afford that. Our career lifestyle supports that. I mean, you know, it essentially involved very little change whatsoever. You know, we were living in a cave to begin with. And it's, you know, you just have to be cognizant of that privilege that, you know, for so many other people, this whole mess has been so much worse. So, you know, we're okay. I mean, we did have we had an interlude where things got a little more alarming. I mean, my wife has been open about this, but she was diagnosed with breast cancer late last year.
Oof.
And you know, that was a very surprise diagnosis. It was literally you know, the previous year's you know, mammogram and examination had turned up nothing. So it was, you know, fortunately, it was literally that new. It was that incipient. It was that small and that fresh, and it was caught really early. So in as much as there's an optimal cancer outcome, we appear to currently be in that zone. You know, fingers crossed, touch wood.
Yeah, man, fingers crossed. Oof.
You know, and, you know, the radiology that she was able to receive is already, you know, significantly more advanced than what she would have been able to receive, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. So the side effects, you know, unpleasant as they have been mitigated. And the fact is that this the diagnosis came after the rollout of the vaccines. So while it was still a massive pain in the ass, like I had to drop her off at the cancer clinic. I couldn't be in there with her. I couldn't wait in the waiting room for all whatever 32 sessions of radiation that she went to.
Oh, that's harrowing.
And that's a short course of radiation. You know, and less torturous than it could have been because, you know, at least she could move her head. She wasn't, you know, chained in place with something out of a you know, a frickin' superhero movie. I mean, there's worse. There's always worse.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're very fortunate that, you know, we live in an area that takes, you know, that takes basic biosafety relatively seriously. You know, we pay for very good insurance. We're able to afford very good insurance, and you know, it was not the height of the pandemic when there was actually, you know, we were actually able to get in on the therapeutic schedule and get this done. So, you know, if you have to get a very small case of cancer, I mean, that was the time to get it 7-8 months ago. So, you know, that threw another spoke into the wheel and put us back to, you know, more stringent precautions of, you know, not seeing people, you know, even within our little cultivated bubbles of people being equally cautious, we had to take further steps back and, you know, accept that, you know, her immune system is going to be, you know, under assault for a couple of months and we're not taking any chances. But, you know, like I said, we appear to have every indication of a really positive outcome in that respect. And, you know, I had my own little medical issue mid-pandemic that I, you know, something I'd meant to go in and get checked up on, you know, just before it was breaking out, and then was finally able to get a physical examination for like 18 months later. Oof. And, you know, it's a pain in the ass. It turns out that I'm one of several members of my family who have a moderate incipient liver condition. And, you know, in my case, I emphasize incipient, as in we're still in the stage of you need to correct your behavior and watch yourself rather than you have a serious issue. You want to prevent this from becoming a serious issue.
Yeah.
And as, you know, crazy as it sounds, but, you know, maybe it doesn't sound crazy. You know, it's just, it's such a relief to get a diagnosis that that makes sense and doesn't start with a capital C. You know, you work yourself up into such a state of dread thinking, oh, shit, what if it's cancer? What if it's cancer? And then you find out that, thank God, it's just necrotic zombie spores chewing on my liver and slowly turning me into a lich. Thank God it's not cancer.
Well, I mean, at least the latter, like it, you know, it applies to what you do for a living, right? You can turn that into a story.
You know, it's really the only thing is that what it's done and what it's forced me to do is that I've seriously curtailed my drinking over the last year. It's now been more than a year since the diagnosis. I would go teetotal if it was necessary for my health. Like if it really came down to that, I'd do it in an instant. But it didn't seem like it was necessary to do that. But I did cut my alcohol intake by 75% across the board on a week by week basis. I now have a very strict limitation on how much I drink, and you know, it also doesn't help that you know, I was drinking an awful lot during the years from 2016 to 2021 for some reason, and so there was a lot to tone down, but it has been toned down, and honestly, I feel a lot better about it.
That's good. I'm really glad to hear that.
It you know, I like drinking. I don't have many vices. Basically, caffeine and alcohol. I don't smoke. I don't do anything else exciting. I don't hang glide. I don't cave dive.
Yeah.
You know, but I do like a drink every now and again. You know, we make cocktails. We have fancy cocktail shakers. We have a pretty good liquor collection. So it is a slight imposition, but I would also rather live. And, you know, so it, also, you know, the beautiful theory is, you know, if I live a strict discipline 50 weeks of the year, then, you know, once or twice a year at a convention or at Christmas or whatever, you know, I can go hog wild and maybe have 5 drinks in a week.
Man.
But so that's I'm sorry. God, I don't mean to whine about my booze intake, you know, 15 minutes into the podcast and Scott unloading about how he can't drink as much scotch as he used to.
Everybody's got their thing that they're dealing with. Like, yeah, like mine's sugar, honestly, like mine's food. I've been feeling terrible the last 6 months or so physically, and I finally went to my rheumatologist and I said, "Are you sure that my arthritis isn't getting worse? Because I've got rheumatoid arthritis." And he said, "No, this is like more like soft tissue inflammation. I want you to go off sugar." And I just looked at him like, "The fuck I will."
Ah, yeah, sure. I will also grow wings.
Right, exactly. But I did take him seriously, and I went about, I think about a month ago, I cut about 2/3 of my sugar intake, and honestly, I'm feeling better and I hate it.
Yeah, I know. I vividly recall, you know, cause I'm 44 now, and I vividly recall being like 20 and sleeping 4 hours a night and living entirely on Mountain Dew and cold pizza and Doritos. And it's like, I gave those years of my life when I could live on garbage, you know, to a bullshit company that no longer exists. I wish I could have those years back to apply to abusing myself now.
Right.
All right. I wish I could go, if I had a time machine, I'd hop back to about 1998 and steal my own liver, kidneys, knees, etc. Cause that little shit wasn't doing anything useful with them. I could use those things now.
Yeah, for real. That's how I feel about my body, right? Just like the whole thing. Could I just replace it with, you know, the one I had when I was 18?
Yes. God, this is turned into that thing, you know, middle-aged people got to tell the youth what it's going to be like, and the youth don't want to listen.
I know, right?
I didn't want to listen when I was the youth, but now that I'm not the youth, in a literary sense, we're very young. I mean, we're going to be, you know, you're a young writer until you're about 75, you know, Harlan Ellison was past 80 when he died. And there were still people out there who were like, that young Turk piece of shit. So, you know, it's a very chronologically forgiving, you know, career that we've chosen for ourselves, but still it's like, it's that realization like, man, were all the adults in my life feeling like this when I was growing up, were they all hiding this? Were they just waiting for their revenge?
Well, I think about the like massive pile of pills that I watched my dad take every morning when I was a kid, like, you know, prescribed pills, like just for all the various things wrong with his body. And I'm like, oh man, I'm starting to create that pile myself. And I'm only in my mid 30s. Like, what the crap?
No. Yeah. And, you know, I, like I said, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I don't have a hell of a lot to complain about, you know, for a hereditary asthmatic migraine sufferer, clinical depressive with liver issues, I'm honestly doing pretty okay. It could be a hell of a lot worse. I find it more amusing than anything, the little indignities of one's body slowly betraying oneself. Although honestly, you know, if I had that time machine, I would go back like 25 years and grab my late teenage self and tell him to fucking sit in his chair properly.
All right.
Quit hunching like a vulture, you flexible little pool noodle of a man, because you will not be able to do that forever. And holy, you will pay for it. Just you be more reasonable to yourself, you pretzel.
Man, about 3-4 years ago, I went ahead and got myself like a really nice, like, office desk chair. And holy crap, that's been one of the best, you know, like, expenditures of my professional life. I'm in it so often. I used to think that fancy was the $200 chair at Costco.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, that's the fanciest I'll ever need. Turns out that that's actually still quite garbage for your body. And man, you need something good. You need and good posture. Ugh, I hate having to take care of myself.
Yeah. The maintenance is such a pain in the ass. You know, you reach that age where it's like, why do I hurt? Oh, it's because I moved. Why do I hurt now? Oh, it's because I didn't move. Like, it gets you coming and going. You can't do anything right. Oh, I slept funny. Guess I won't be able to walk for a week.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I have an Aeron chair. This is the second one I've owned. And I'm looking at some of the, like, I know people who've been buying high-end gaming chairs,
mm-hmm.
For use as office chairs and podcasting chairs, because a lot of them are apparently very comfy and orthopedically useful. And, you know, I am whining. I mean, I threw my back out very severely it was either 2013 or 2014, but it's long enough now that I don't remember the exact date, but it was one of those summers. And it was horrendous. I mean, it was 6 weeks of hellish pain and, you know, taking 45 minutes to get out of bed, screaming all the way. I mean, I did bad things to my lower back. And I took measures to correct that. And I've not been like that since. I have not had a repeating incident for almost 7 years. So I consider that a big success. But the chair is a big part of it. And also just, you know, catching myself, not slouching, stretching more frequently, you know, getting up and actually taking breaks.
Yeah.
You know, I do half-assed yoga because I'm a big, goony, inflexible, tall dude. But, you know, I still try.
I mean, that's more than most people, I think. So it's good.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, honestly, you know, despite our whining, like it does not actually have to suck. You do not actually have to become, you know, a shambling garbage fire of a human being just because the clock rolled past 40. But you do need, like, I played traveling soccer when I was a kid, when I was 15, 16, you know, thereabouts. And one of my years, I had a U16 soccer coach named Mr. Wong, who played, he was then 42. He was then just slightly younger than I am now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 42, my God, are people even made that old? Whoa, wow, we're never going to be that old. And he played on adult competitive leagues, and he could do the splits like a hockey goalie. And he sternly cautioned us. You know, he said he was out there, you know, leading us in stretches, practice after practice, and you know, typically beating all of us. And he said, look, if you want to be able to do this when you're 42, kids, you got to start stretching now and you got to keep exercising until you are my age. You can't just let it sit. And of course, we all took his advice and listened very, very seriously.
I bet.
Oh, well. But, you know, it is an essential life maintenance thing. I mean, you know, putting on my serious literary thinking hat here, like it's very, very difficult to concentrate on what you're doing, to enjoy writing, to want to sit in front of a keyboard when your back is a constant mess of aches, you know, and you know, when your body is chewing on you, when the pain is gnawing at you. I mean, chronic pain is a horrendous thing to work through, even if it's mostly self-inflicted. So, you know, there's this age old geekish disdain for the meat, you know, and this sort of workaholic urge to just, you know, ignore that. The mind is what's important, you know, throw yourself into your work and ignore the demands of your feeble meat frame. But you need to approach your health holistically. Like, I mean, you cannot maintain useful productivity. You cannot maintain creativity if your body is in constant rebellion against you. It's hellish.
Well, and there's more and more studies coming out about linking your physical health with your mental health. And, you know, these things are very tightly intertwined.
Mm-hmm. I mean, people think I'm kidding, but, you know, I was a volunteer firefighter for 11 years and I had some interesting spills. I got a lot of bruises, but I was never seriously injured in the course of that. I mean, I rolled down hillsides in the rain. I got slightly burned on a couple occasions. I fell off of stuff. You know, I bounced down stairs in smoke and fire. I mean, I had, you know, a lot of scrapes, but I never, ever seriously hurt myself. All of my serious adult injuries have come as a result of bad posture. Like, ridiculous as it sounds, you know, the summer of screaming back pain was strictly from bad posture. It will sneak up on you, and when it assassinates your ability to function normally, yeah, I mean, you will not believe how vicious it is. So
it's absolutely rough.
It sounds ridiculous, but you know, without over dramatizing it, you do have to take care of yourself, you know, in any way you can.
Hello, Page Break listeners. Brian here to let you know that my next epic fantasy, In the Shadow of Lightning, is now up for pre-order from Tor Books. Glass Immortals is a whole new universe that introduces you to assassinations, intrigue, industrial magic, harrowing battles, heartbreaking disasters, and more for new readers and old. The book is out in the US on June 21st and can be pre-ordered from Amazon, Audible, Barnes & Noble, or get a signed copy straight from my website. Remember, pre-orders matter massively to a new book, so make sure you get that done. Thank you all so much for the support. Now enjoy the rest of the podcast.
We had discussed briefly via email, but what's the writing been like lately?
It would be hilarious if you could, like, edit in a whole bunch of bleeps just to pretend like I was about to unleash some gigantic revelation. Like, yeah, I collaborated with Hideo Kojima on this groundbreaking next level beep, beep, beep. But the ship sank, beep, and so there are no copies of the book, beep, and the game will be released in maybe 2027. you know, or I can supply my own beeps. Okay, I guess, you know, we did talk about this, and I guess it is time to talk about this. You may be the actual first person that I'm talking about this with, though I have every expectation, like, it's early May right now, and I have every expectation that this will not be released to the public until late May or early June. I will explicate my issue at length, possibly more than I ever have, because, you know, the world at large knows that I'm a pretty serious clinical depressive. I've been open about that since 2010. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a life-changing diagnosis. That was a life-changing problem. You know, it interrupted my career. It interrupted my first marriage and helped bring it to an end. And, you know, getting that to a state of relative stability was, you know, it's been years. I've been through three different therapists. I've been through a couple different drug regimens. I've now been working on that for, you know, it's 2022. So it's been about 12 years that I've been actively working on it. But that aspect of the problem has been really stable for a long time. Like, you don't just magically stop having funky brain juice.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can you know, with assiduous attention, like you can mitigate and you can make changes in your lifestyle and your approach. You can find clinical solutions, like you can restore a lot of the functionality that you didn't know that you were missing. It's not an option for everybody, and everybody's case is going to be absolutely different. But in my case, like the periods of you know, black dog depression, where, you know, I wouldn't answer the phone for 6 weeks, or I wouldn't answer my email for months, where, you know, I would flinch from even opening it. You know, I couldn't communicate with the outside world, and I was just totally dysfunctional as a human being. I mean, that has not happened for years. You know, these days, you know, my depression manifests itself as, you know, probably a couple bad afternoons a month. You know, I will find myself behaving in a certain way. And because of, you know, years of analysis and therapy and, you know, working on solutions and working on feedback, I will catch myself and I will go, oh, you are behaving like this because, you know, this is depressive behavior. You're doing it right now, live, as you watch. And that doesn't magically make it better, but it makes it so much easier to deal with than back in the day when I was, you know, living in total dysfunction and denial about it. So the other aspect of it that that has been causing a lot of trouble is the fact that it also unleashed a whole plethora of anxiety disorders and, you know, ongoing panic attacks that just were not a factor in my life prior to about 2009 and 2010. And, you know, this is one of those things that will again sound ridiculous, but I don't have writer's block. I've never had anything resembling writer's block. I believe it's a thing, but it's really never been my issue. I've never had a productivity block. I've been working steadily throughout, you know, the whole pandemic. I've been working steadily for the last 10 years. I have a whole pile of shit that I would absolutely love to show to people. But my problem is that I have crippling panic attacks about showing my work to people, about revealing what I've been working on, about breaching my privacy, about handing my work in, which is a really ridiculous fucking thing for someone who is a professional writer to have. But, you know, it wasn't there at the beginning of my career. You know, I wrote The Lies of Locke Lamora, handed that in, you know, a couple months later than we might have hoped back in 2005, just because it was my first novel. I didn't know what I was doing. I then wrote Red Seas Under Red Skies relatively rapidly without issue, and that got delivered in February 2007. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, bang, 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 out it was going. And after that, in 2008-ish is when the trouble really started. And by the time, you know, it came to the summer of my divorce and the aftermath of that, I mean, I was an absolute anxiety wreck, you know, panic attack wreck. And it, you know, anxiety attack and panic attack, I mean, they sound like such relatively mild things, like, oh, I've got a mild case of the frights. But anybody who suffers from real medical grade panic attacks understands that it's not, ooh, I've got the heebie-jeebies, ooh, I've got the fright. It's, you know, it's like having your chest locked in iron bands. It's like, you know, having your, feeling your blood pressure swell, feeling your fingers stiffen, feeling your, you know, your hearing your pulse in your head like hoofbeats, you know, falling to the ground, being unable to do anything. You know, it's, and then working yourself into a state of preemptive dread at the thought of facing that. It becomes a feedback cycle, you know, so that you come to dread the thought of even thinking about handing something in or showing somebody your work. I mean, you know, that's my fucking trigger. You know, over the last decade, I've managed to get one novel out, and, you know, that was a painful process. I mean, a triumphant and ultimately pleasant, but painful process. I mean, my then girlfriend, now wife, found me on the couch, you know, the morning that I actually turned it in, you know, just kind of rolling around, Joker laughing, sobbing, just kind of half out of my mind because I'd actually done it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was still in the throes of you know, serious anxiety issues. And I've managed to get out about half a dozen short stories. or novellas, since my short stories tend to be on the lengthy side. They often turn up to be novelettes or novellas if you want to get technical about word count.
It's us epic fantasy writers, right?
Yeah, you know, my wife jokes about this a lot. I don't do a lot of work in the like 2,000 to 3,000 word range, or the under 200,000 word range. But you know, a shorter work for me tends to be about 15,000 words, which is not short story. That is absolute, you know, novelette territory, which is completely irrelevant to everything I was talking about. So apologies for that particular digression. As you can see, even when talking about anxiety, one sometimes experiences anxiety and sabotages oneself live and on the air. Well, dead and on the air, since this won't be out for a month. But so, you know, and getting those short stories out of me, you know, I frankly admit that this has been a hellish process for most of my editors. You know, who were for the most part, you know, Jonathan Strahan and the late much missed Gardner Dozois. You know, typically, you know, I would be the last person to be handing my story in, just because, you know, I was having panic paroxysms, not at finishing it, not at doing it. I finished them all. I enjoyed it. I got them all in, but then would come the absolute, you know, the whole panic show, the fireworks inside the skull, the incredible feeling of being unable to breathe, which is, like I said, you know, I was a childhood asthmatic. I don't like that sensation at all. It has a rich history for me. It lives in memory. And, you know, I have been blessed with some of the most patient editors on earth, you know, Jonathan and, you know, Gardner in particular. You know, I will never not cite his incredible kindness to me. I mean, he really stretched the deadlines as far as he possibly could. And he absolutely understood that, you know, a lot of the people he was trying to draw stories out of, you know, had some flavor of anxiety or depression. I mean, that's, you know, a big open secret that shouldn't be a secret about the publishing industry is that, you know, if you're an editor with any length of experience whatsoever, you have a lot of experience at dealing with non-neurotypical authors. You know, I'm not entirely certain that there are many, you know, that we would peg as neurotypical, for whatever that word means. You know, it was a very, very important moment to me, you know, 12 or 13 years ago, when I was finally able to kind of break down and confess my depression diagnosis to my then editor at Gallant, Simon Spanton. And he said, you know, Scott, this is good in a couple of ways, because at least we're communicating and at least we know that there's something actually wrong with you. And not to put too fine a point on it, but do you think you're the first depressed author I've ever dealt with? You know, do you think you're the 10th? Good Lord. No, this is commonplace. This is an occupational hazard, if you want to put it that way. You know, we know how to deal with this. No one's going to look at you funny. You are now a more normal author than you have ever been. And it was a very, very helpful, you know, speech that he gave me. But so yeah. And you know, part of this is my problem is that I realize in hindsight that I made something of a mistake psychologically and professionally in kind of breaking down my depression and my anxiety into two separate problems that I wanted to approach as separate problems. And my various therapists have, you know, tried to work more holistically, but it really wasn't until the last couple of years that I started to look at it as one big package that needs to be addressed together rather than something that can be broken down discreetly and, you know, dealt with in detail, as it were. So what has been fucking me up, what's been holding me back is, you know, it's interesting. I'm more communicative about my issues than some people whose books are very overdue. But I still don't reveal a lot of information about this online, at least not in the last couple of years. You know, I've tried to be relatively honest about it, but I've also found sometimes that, you know, that honesty can be taken by people and used in a very cruel fashion. And it's just not like I'm at the limit of talking about the personal information that I want to give, because I know that, you know, with the best of intentions, you know, even if it comes from a place of genuine empathy and sympathy and wanting to help, when you talk about this, when you talk about, you know, mental illness, when you talk about medications, when you talk about courses of therapy, people line up to fucking give you advice. Have you done this? Have you done that? Have you tried this? Have you tried that? And I have absolutely no intention of discussing my private medical needs. Like this is not open to a vote.
Yeah.
You know, like, I guess I should say I'll talk about it, but I am not inviting a fucking response. And I'm not asking for, you know, solutions. I've already been driven up the wall, you know, here and there by solutions that are, you know, from my perspective, you know, absolute woo-woo. You know, you get people who mean well, you know, offering you everything from, you know, magnetic bracelets to crystals to whatever. And it's like, no. Keep it to your fucking self. Keep it to yourself. You know, I'm not willing to accept random medical advice from qualified professionals. Keep your magic to yourself. It's enough to know that you wish me well and I thank you for it. And let's not talk about it.
Yeah.
God, I'm being a real dick at the moment. I don't mean to be. It's just that I think you understand what I'm getting at. That like the more of yourself you open up online, the more time you sometimes have to spend filtering the weirdness that you get in response.
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of the problems with having this sort of public persona is that people that follow you on social media, they oftentimes through no fault of their own, this is just kind of the nature of social media, they kind of become they get this idea that they know you, that maybe they're a friend to you. And so, yeah, like you were saying, it's they'll try to give unsolicited advice as if they were a friend. And a lot of times, especially when it comes to things like mental health, you don't even want that unsolicited advice from your actual friends, let alone strangers on the internet. And that's really hard to deal with when you're bombarded by it.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, the for the same reason, and this will make sense in 30 seconds, bear with me here. Like for the same reason, I've kind of gone on a personal crusade to purge from my repertoire of banter. I no longer make like tall jokes about my really tall friends. I no longer make short jokes about my really short friends. Like in the dedications for my first two novels, there's a dedication to a particular friend who is relatively short. And I've made a joke about it in the dedication a couple of times. I've stopped fucking doing that because it's so easy to mean well and not realize that you are not the first person who has said this. You are the 1,000th this year alone. And, you know, you are not being original. You are just being an intrusive jackass, you know, and medical advice is a lot like that. You know, have you heard of this? Have you tried this? Like, yes, I have. You are the 1,000th person to suggest it to me. You know, John Scalzi got this back in the day when he taped bacon to his cat and took a picture of it. You know, everyone and their cousin for the next, like, you know, 5 years was constantly, like, if they found a reference to bacon or cats online, must notify John Scalzi, which is funny and pleasant the first 100 times it happens. But then, like, by customer 10,000, you're like, stop with the bacon and the cats, okay? I do other things.
You become a meme of yourself, almost. Very strange.
Yeah, you know, or you know, people linking Wikipedia articles on stuff to which you are, you know, peripherally related, you know, like there are female pirates in my second novel. And listen, readers, I love you. I really love you. I appreciate everything you do. And I understand this comes from a place of wanting parasocial connection. It comes from a place of wanting to participate. It comes from a place of wanting to share. And that's awesome. But yes, I am aware of the existence of, you know, literally every female pirate with a major Wikipedia article because people sent them to me 500 times. Like, I know. Yes. Women have been on boats before. Thank you so much. And you know, and it's like I said, it sounds churlish. I know I'm being a dick right now. It's like, how dare you pay attention to me and want to play games with me in public and want to have fun based on stuff that I have done. But it's like at some level, like, I know, Jesus, I know, let it die. Let it go. anyhow. So yeah, that's the very long version of like why I try to be relatively guarded about some of my health information. I mean, coming out in the open and admitting that, you know, hey, I'm a serious depressive. I'm in treatment for it. It's you know, it's not fun. It's a very real thing. It was liberating in a lot of respects. It was useful in a lot of respects. And I received so much genuine sympathy and so much useful communication and so much from so many people that I am so absolutely grateful for. But, you know, in 2022, there are things that I will not do. Like, I will not discuss the actual drug that I am taking. I will not discuss dosage. I will not discuss the intimate details of my medical processes because they're for me and my family and my health practitioners and nobody else.
Yeah.
Like I said, this stuff is not up for a vote. So with that said, you know, trying to give as much honest information as possible. You know, why is there no finished Gentleman Bastard sequence? Where are all the fucking books? Well, the problem is that for the last decade or so, you know, I fall down in a conniption fit every time I try to fucking show things to people. And the stuff that I have shown to people, you know, it's like, you know, breaking my chest open and pulling the ribs apart and clawing my own heart out. You know, it's a difficult process. And I've felt so close to various breakthroughs at various points. I mean, each of my major therapists has been very useful in a particular area. Each of them has had a different approach and a different emphasis. And like together, they have formed Therapist Voltron and given me a very good holistic program of mental and physical health this last decade. And I've come so close to points where it's like, God damn, I think I'm having a breakthrough. I think this might work. I think this might be, you know, I think I might be a semi-useful human being again. And it's you know, come fucking crashing down. You know, I finished a draft of Thorn of Emberlane more than 2 years ago now that I was very proud of at the time, and it still needs some work, but. You know, bound up with doing that work is the fact that, you know, I've also been, you know, flinching and panicking and dying at the thought of just fucking showing it to people. So, you know, the reports online that, you know, oh, he turned it in years ago, his publishers have it. No, I didn't. I finished it years ago. My publishers don't have it. Nobody's seen it because, you know, because I have a serious, serious fucking issue. You know, and my publishers know all about it. I know that they're not best pleased by it, but you know, they're well aware that you know, that this has really fucked me up. You know, depression stole a couple years out of the heart of my career, and I was feeling great. I mean, 2013 was a great year once that book was turned in. I had such a fantastic time. It really felt like, you know, I might be on the path to becoming a normal, relatively functional author, you know, again. And, you know, I've certainly been able to do a lot of the normal functional author stuff. You know, I did bookstore appearances, I did conventions, I did podcasts, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, the fundamental problem of being unable to show work to people, of being unable to share my, you know, my creations just did not go away. It got worse, which brings us to 2022. So the update is that as of early May 2022, I haven't handed in The Thorn of Emberlane, the fourth novel in the Gentleman Bastard sequence, and I don't have a timeline on when that might be handed in. There's nothing going on in secret. No one is sitting on it except me. But something has happened, which is that the aforementioned process of trying to find some kind of therapeutic and or pharmaceutical solution to damp my fucking anxiety down. I mean, you know, we've tried various workarounds. You know, we've tried the whole thought of, you know, what if you just put your work into, you know, a remote drive and had your wife turn it in? What if you just left a thumb drive sitting around somewhere where she could scoop it up? And it's like, it sounds ridiculous. That doesn't help.
Yeah,
I flinch from that in the exact same way because it is still... It still represents a certain finality of putting my work out in the world. And, you know, for better or for worse, I want a solution that involves me being at least marginally more functional. I don't want to have to set up some kind of fucking Rube Goldberg device, pardon my French. So, you know, I don't want to have to contrive some, you know, some mechanism where I, like, you know, leave a thumb drive, hypnotize myself and leave a thumb drive out where someone will will grab it and pass it to a courier who leaves it in a dead drop who gives it to my agent. I want to be functional at the minimal level to be able to hand my work in.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, I handed some work in.
Well, tell me about it.
We have found, and the thing is, I was feeling really, really good around August of last year. I was starting to find myself in a zone where we'd done something that was actually having a significant effect, and my anxiety was diminishing tangibly, and it was great. And then along came the surprise cancer diagnosis. So I was a fucking basket case for another, 5 months after that. So now that that's sorted, I've returned to the set of processes that that we've cooked up and that have been steadily having a very calming influence on my anxiety. And they appear to be working really nicely at the moment. So for the longest period of time, I have owed Subterranean Press a set of novellas or short novels. The first of which is titled The Mad Baron's Mechanical Attic, and the second of which is titled The Choir of Knives, mm-hmm. and the third of which was untitled. But I'll get to that in a moment.
You have such better titles than I do.
I love them. Take that, McClellan. That's why I'm here. I'm stuck with untitled Lynch number 3 though for the third novella. So I mean I'm not unassailable. I'm not perfect.
Yeah, you'll get it though.
We're working on it. So I signed a contract for these things back in like literally 2005. I mean these things the proposed existence of these things predates the publication of The Lies of Locke Lamora. And poor Bill at Subterranean Press has endured the passing of geologic ages. I mean, we signed this contract in the Second Age. It is now the Third Age, and the ring is going to Mordor. It has been a while. And I just handed the first of these in.
That is freaking fantastic.
So I guess, fuck, man. I guess Brandon is the cutting edge. He had 4 surprise novellas. I only have 3 surprise novellas. I couldn't get up to 4. But the thing is, when this project was originally announced back in like 2005, they were just 3 untitled novellas, could be anything. And then, based on some commentary from a friend, I got the notion that, oh, it would be cool to make this a sort of a prequel to The Lies of Locke Lamora, detailing how Locke and Jean get their hands on a cask of brandy that becomes very important. It serves the role of the Spanish prisoner in the story of The Lies of Locke Lamora. Mm-hmm. And I was really enthusiastic about that at first, but as a couple of years went by, I kind of came to realize that I was not willing to write what I considered to be an inessential prequel. I mean, I'm a real snob about prequels. And I think that our culture is really, really good at generating, for some reason, completely inessential prequels that actually undercut rather than strengthen the works that they are supposed to support. Like, this is why I'm such a huge fan of Better Call Saul. There are many reasons to be, a fan of Better Call Saul, but also Like it's amazing that they've squeezed six seasons of astonishing television out of this milieu filled with characters that we know cannot get killed, cannot change state, cannot have vast revelations before the Breaking Bad timeline begins. And they've still managed to write a fascinating show full of twists and turns and surprises. So I was not willing to write an inessential sequel, which is a prequel, which is why that little prequel had to go bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would have been fun, but there was nothing meaty there. There was nothing new. You know, I just can't do it. So eventually what happened was I realized that I could reuse the setting and a lot of these events and just move these novellas chronologically to place them between The Republic of Thieves and The Thorn of Emberlane to sort of form a bridge narrative, which is, you know, like my pledge is that you can read all seven Gentleman Bastards novels and not need subsidiary material. That, you know, that nothing essential will be put into another book. But I can do a lot of fun stuff that illuminates a lot of what's to come and gives us more time with, you know, Locke and John being boneheads on the road and getting kicked around by fate before we get back into the war and the politics and the big mainline plots of the main sequence of novels. So it is inessential yet illuminating, and that I can do. So it's a sequel to The Republic of Thieves and a prequel to The Thorn of Emberlane. And you know, you won't miss a thing if you don't read them, but they should be a lot of fun if you do.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
And the thing is that originally, like I said, the first one was supposed to be called The Mad Baron's Mechanical Attic, and the second one was The Choir of Knives. Now they are called Untitled Lynch Number 1 because I don't have a fucking title for it. And then The Mad Baron's Mechanical Attic, and then The Choir of Knives. That's how the trilogy is shaken out. That's how the shape finally came together in my mind.
Ah, okay.
Which is that, so the first novel is Locke and John on the run after the events of The Republic of Thieves, you know, steadily moving west, you know, running little scams to you know, help ends meet. And just, you know, progressing toward the discovery of the plot point that will take them to the fourth novel and beyond. And I'm thinking strongly that the trilogy in that these three novellas together will be called the Road to Emberlane trilogy. That's either really perfect or way too fucking obvious. It could go either way. Like, so it depends on what all of my editors and my agent and my wife, to be honest, all come back with when the great vote is held.
Yeah.
And when I am told what I'm going to do, that either that title is perfect or it's bullshit. But that's what it is in my head at the moment. And, you know, also hopefully after some discussion in the coming weeks, we can come up with a cool title for the first book rather than Untitled Lynch Number 1. Cause I'm drawing a fucking blank. I'm very happy with it as a piece of work, but I don't know what to call it. And that's unusual for me. So, you know, I'm hoping that by the time this podcast goes out, I mean, that should be a public announcement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what I'm waiting on at the moment is basically, you know, a consensual game plan with all the parties involved as to how we're going to proceed and what we're going to announce and when we're going to announce it. And there are, you know, a couple different, you know, I've got two publishers. Two large publishers, a small publisher, and an agent to keep happy, and everyone has to arrive at some kind of consensus. So we're still waiting for that to happen. But I expect that it will be accomplished within the next month.
Oh, fingers crossed.
And so you will not actually have to blank out 25 minutes of this podcast, because that would be a little bit obnoxious.
I mean, more likely I would just push it back a bit further.
Yeah, I'm hoping that it will not have to go much further back. But so a thing was handed in, you know, and I chose that because it was near to completion. I was ready and willing to complete it. It seemed like a good dry run for handing something bigger in, and it's gone off without a hitch. You know, I didn't have a panic attack. I've I'm not entirely without consequences, but it's nothing like what's been hitting me for the last decade. You know, it's absolutely nothing like the goddamn punishment my brain has dished out at me, you know, since 2010. This level of discomfort is positively heavenly. I would happily take this if it means that I could turn stuff in. And if this means what I think it means, then it means that just in time for nuclear war or whatever is coming down the road, I'm hopefully going to reemerge this year as an author in public.
Oh man, fingers crossed for you, man.
And, you know, have a lot of shit all over the place, because I've also got some Locke and John short stories. I've got three at the moment that are finished in draft. I've got a lot of stuff that I've been working on that I would love to release in the run up to the Thorn of Emberlane. I mean, that's also why I'm trying to pursue this plan of getting these novellas out as well, at least one of them, because they fit in between the novels and might serve as a really good ramp up to that big release that everyone's hopefully looking for. But, you know, I've got an online novel called Queen of the Iron Sands that I'd like to resuscitate. If I can actually release stuff again without having a goddamn panic attack every time I think about it, then I'm going to be fucking insufferable for a couple of years, because I'm sitting on a backlog. I'm ready to do this shit again. This is what I want to be doing. You know, that's the one thing that is difficult to take, you know, and I should stress that, like, I'm not particularly beat up in terms of online commentary. Like, people are very mean to George and Pat in particular. You know, I don't get the same level of viciousness. I also, you know, like, I don't sell as many books as George R. R. Martin does. I mean, that's obvious, but like, I don't get the same level of vituperation, for which I'm grateful, and all that vituperation sucks in general.
Yeah.
But what I do occasionally get are people kind of expressing the thought that this is something that I've chosen, that, you know, I'm just dicking around, that I don't want to release another book, or, you know, I've just elected not to write a novel. And it's like, no, but also, like I said, you know, I've opted to be relatively private about the true nature of what my anxiety issues do to me until now-ish. Mm-hmm. You know, so I can't exactly fault people for not realizing that. But no, like, this is not a deliberate program of fucking with people that I undertook. This is not a conscious decision to sit back and not write. I mean, I've been writing continually. It's a painful inability to release my work that may now actually finally be coming to a fucking end after, you know, my career has not exactly been from an income perspective and a book sales perspective. I mean, my books have been selling steadily and selling better year after year. You know, I maintain a ridiculous degree of market presence for a guy who hasn't released a novel in 9 fucking years. And I'm immensely grateful for that. That's lovely. But I also want to be a functional, productive fucking writer. I want to be a part of the commercial and artistic conversation. That's what the whole thing is about. I'd like to be getting the work out and not just doing it and sealing it, you know, away on my hard drive. So, you know, I am punch drunk, I guess. I'm bewildered and very excited, because, you know, I've been living with relative disappointment for so long, and living with, you know, failure after failure to find some solution, that the fact that we've finally apparently reached one, it's kind of surreal, you know?
I mean, I hope in a really good way, that it, which is what it sounds like.
There's nothing about it that's not positive, but it's still surreal. It's weird. It's like, is it actually really fucking happening? You know, am I finally at the level of functionality I probably should have been at 8 years ago? You know, please God.
And I can say confidently that, like, everybody else in the industry, that everybody's rooting for you, man. Like, everybody loves you, and everybody loves your books, and we're really looking forward to seeing things.
Not true. But thank you. But screw those people. No, I knowing that, you know, adoration for me is not universal, I nonetheless feel that I am very, very blessed by the generally positive response to my work. I'm very, very cognizant of how lucky I am, and I absolutely love it. I treasure it. And it has sustained me. I mean, you know, the readership has built the long tail that the books have enjoyed. You know, these people have gone out on a limb for me, you know, year in and year out, passing the book around, recommending it to friends. You know, the phenomenon has built itself because of the care and attention of the people who've read the books. You know, and I will never forget that.
Yeah, for sure. I was kind of curious. I wanted to slightly pivot, but this is very tied into our discussion on kind of mental health.
Sure.
Because you mentioned that you were watching Moon Knight.
Yes.
And as I've mentioned on the podcast before, my wife has got severe mental illness, and watching it with her has been really interesting, from an outside perspective. And I'm kind of curious how you felt about it.
Moon Knight has been interesting because, you know, a lot of it is carried on the shoulders of Oscar Isaac, who could act reading the phone book in a way that is fascinating. I mean, he's
so good.
Like, you know, I'm a cishet dude, so I'm not even in the, like, you know, oh, he's so pretty camp. But even I'm like, this guy is really compelling. Mm-hmm. Like, you could just watch him do anything. Moon Knight is a very creative show. I'm enjoying its atmosphere. It's episodes are occasionally hot messes. Like, its overall structure has not gone whole hot mess. It's an interesting show, and it has not totally lost its shit yet. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not as coherently marvelously weird and experimental as WandaVision was. I mean, that would be my nomination for, like, the most intriguing and genuinely creative Marvel property that has yet been produced. But I am enjoying it, and this is holding its own, and I'm finding that I'm really enjoying this conception of you know, Steven/Mark serving a sort of scruffy, disreputable, you know, exiled god who, you know, he's been locked out of his offices by the other gods.
Yeah.
And the whole Egyptian pantheon as kind of this, you know, this foreclosed company that has shut its infrastructure down and just, like, maintains a skeleton crew to keep their little portion of the cosmos running. Like, there are so many questions this all invites, but it's fun. And I'm finding that I think they're doing a really good job of dealing with the dissociative identity as it's presented in this TV series, which is not quite the way it was in the original comics, as I understand. But, like, you know, they've done a bullet points version of that and made it its own thing. They're doing a really good job of drawing dramatic power out of it without exoticizing or fetishizing it or you know, going too fucking over the top with it. Mm-hmm. You know, speaking as like, they're getting the alarm and the confusion and the worry, you know, right. You know, just from my perspective as somebody who's, you know, like I said, I've had a lot of time now to look at myself and be with my thoughts, you know, about my depression and my own issues. And they're really getting that whole aspect of, you know, God, how am I injured? What's wrong with me? Am I ever going to be whole? Do I have to be like this? Is this even a true realization? Do I have a true consciousness right now or a false consciousness? Do I understand the real problem that I'm dealing with? Like, and that's a big question for when you're trying to grapple with a mental illness. You know, like, do I have an honest understanding of the situation that I'm in? Or is my condition preventing me from having an honest understanding? Like, that's an existentially dreadful question. And I think they're really handling that part of it well.
Yeah. That was the exact same comment Michelle made, was that, yeah, that panic and difficulty and kind of being able to center and all of that stuff. Really fascinating to see it done well like that.
Yeah, because in less thoughtful hands, it would just be an excuse to, like, let's have the author do some let's have the actor do some Jim Carrey shit. You know,
right, exactly.
Let's have a total flip out. Let's have this guy be a Malkavian vampire, you know, on screen, and let's just be goofy and you know, just make it a big thing. And they're being much more grounded than that. And I absolutely fucking appreciate it. I think it makes it a much more powerful portrayal.
Yeah.
And you know, this is a spoiler for Moon Knight, but I mean, it's a fascinating little thing that they've set up, you know, they've given us five episodes of not answering the question of, you know, what is Mark? What is Stephen? Who was first? Who's the chicken and who's the egg? And then, for Stephen to discover that he is basically a psychological whipping boy, he's an imaginary Cockney archaeologist conjured out of a small boy's affinity for, a shitty B movie to protect himself from horrendous parental abuse. I mean, that's a hell of a thing. It's very clever and it's very interesting and it's very wounding, it's like, wow, Jesus, that's a profound weight to find yourself carrying in addition to all the other weights that you're carrying, so fingers crossed that they don't fuck it up. But I think they're dealing with the subject with a great deal of genuine thoughtfulness that is helping the show to have some grace that otherwise might not, if that makes sense.
Oh, totally makes sense. I mean, when this comes out, the finale will have long been out and people can either nod along and say, oh yeah, they really landed that, or they can laugh at our naivety and say, man, they totally fucked up that last episode. So, we've got like 2 days from this recording is the finale and we are super looking forward to it, but I hope that it's landed.
Oh, okay. It's only a 6-episode series?
That's as far as I know.
Oh, wow. Shit. Okay.
Yeah. So we'll see. Huh,
okay.
I'm looking forward to it, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Fingers crossed. Definitely fingers crossed. And, I'm kind of in the same boat. I mean, I understand. Like I said, I've got a novella, coming up. And this title has been public for 10 years now. But, the title of the novella is The Mad Baron's Mechanical Attic. And I understand that formulation could be considered problematic in some respects. And I had a good long think about this. And the conclusions that I've come to are that, I'm keeping it because, first off, this takes place in a world that does not have our level of, psychological awareness, that does not have our level of therapeutic awareness. And the language that they would use for the condition that the character Baron Ghulam Rajadessa has, is very crude. He's mad by their standards. I feel that my own years in the trenches dealing with my emotional illness, I feel like I have the right to take that Pepsi challenge with anybody who tells me how I should or should not grapple with it. I'm not attempting to stigmatize or exoticize this guy's condition, but the most important thing is that when I started the project that became The Mad Baron's Mechanical Attic back in like 2006, I had no problem whatsoever with just making him literally mad in a completely like Grand Guignol 19th century Penny Dreadful fashion, no actual basis for diagnosis or behavior. He's just mad and he does colorful mad person things. And the thing that I've absolutely done with the final version of the story, given what I've been through and what I now understand, is that I've made absolutely sure that I understand what his condition is and what its symptomology is and what everything he does reflects, and how he has been damaged in life to bring him to this state. So it's still called The Mad Baron's Mechanical Attic, but I've been very, very, very careful to tease out what that actually means, to be as accurate and sympathetic as I can in my actual presentation of that, so that it is hopefully both interesting in a thrilling sword and sorcery sense, but also not damaging and cringeworthy in making a freak and putting him in the spotlight. I've tried to be much more honest about that emotional illness. So I've felt kinship with that process watching Moon Knight. So I hope that I too will manage to pull it off.
That makes total sense. Yeah. That kind of thing is it's difficult to kind of parse those things when you're developing both as a writer, but also maturing as a human being, and also the world is changing and terminology is changing and the way we think about these things is changing, and trying to mess with all of that to figure out what actually goes on the page It's a little bit harder than most people expect.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I don't want to sound resentful about this process, because it's not a process of, you know, oh, people are trying to stifle what I could say. How dare anybody, you know, try to prevent me from writing whatever I want. It's not a process of censorship. It's a process of trying to diminish the amount of cruelty and misunderstanding that we put out into the world and that we accept in the world.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I had one thing that I really wanted to ask you about, and this was, it's a totally left field silly thing.
Woohoo!
I read that you collect old text adventure games. Is that true?
I love Infocom games. They were a formative experience for me when I was, you know, 11 or 12. My family, we didn't own a computer. I didn't own a computer until I was 20. My mom worked for my school district, though, so I was allowed to sneak into the computer lab, and we were allowed to occasionally borrow, like, an Apple IIgs and bring it home over the summer. So that was how I occasionally played computer games when I was a kid. And so I borrowed from the local library the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy text game, Planetfall, Zork, and various Zork sequels, and the one that was the biggest influence on me of all, written by a guy named Steve Moretzky, was a game called A Mind Forever Voyaging. I did a printout of it as I was playing it, you know, playing on an Apple II circa 1991, you know, with an old dot matrix printer, you know, the paper with the punch holes at both sides.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, you're what? You're like 36?
My dad had, the reason I brought this up is because we had an Apple IIe when I was a kid. And a very formative part of me becoming a avid gamer was playing just the demo of one of those old adventure text games over and over and over again.
Yeah, my library had a disc that was it was four demos for four different Infocom games. Like, one of them, there was a mystery game, I think it was called Deadline. There was the first part of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. There was Douglas Adams's Bureaucracy, and then there was like some sort of underwater adventure game, and then there was a swashbuckling bodice ripper romance game. I fell head over heels for text adventure games. You know, I played a little bit of graphical adventure games at the time. I played one of the King's Quest games, mm-hmm. those Sierra games. But the text adventures were where my heart was. And also, I taught myself BASIC so that I could sort of program half-assed games of my own. I did that around seventh or eighth grade. They were a formative game playing experience for me. They were a formative fiction experience, and they were a formative role playing experience. You know, long before I played Dungeons and Dragons or Call of Cthulhu or anything of that nature, I was homebrewing role playing games that were input wise and structure wise based on text adventure games, because that was the framework I had to operate in. So I collect old Infocom games, in particular, in their boxes with their little doodads, because the company would include little bits of fluff, props, and, you know, cute little gimmicks with each of them. So that is one of my weird dorky habits.
I think that's fantastic. I just, when I read that, it brought up this like super powerful memory for me that I hadn't thought about in years.
So you know exactly what games I'm talking about.
I know exactly what games you're talking about. And I, like I said, I only played that one demo, but I remember it vividly. I remember every little part of it. And I played it again and again and again. And we just didn't buy extra things. My parents didn't really believe in video games. I think my brother had gotten it from a friend. And so, yeah, but that was incredibly formative for me.
Yeah, same boat. I'm still massively enthused about that stuff. I've played around with, in the years since then, I've occasionally played around with stuff like the Z Engine, various languages for creating interactive fiction. There's still a big interactive fiction game contest that runs every year, and there's a fairly vibrant interactive fiction community that's been around for, you know, three decades plus now. So, you know, it's because it's so simple. It's one of those art forms that you just can't eradicate. It's one of those electronic cockroaches. There's just no getting rid of it.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. And it's very approachable for normal people because that's, yeah. Oh man. I love that kind of stuff. I love that kind of the days before, I know this is going to sound dumb and old and bemoaning, but the days before you had a million options for, you know, your attention, for gaming, for all this stuff, you just had a few different things to choose from. And it was such an adventure to find those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I was there. I lived through it. I still don't remember how we functioned like before the internet, before Google Maps. I mean, you know, discovering music and books and so on and so forth. I mean, it was a very archaic time, kids. We would all pedal our Flintstones cars down to the dinosaur bookstore, and the Brontosaurus would hand you a book, which was a stone tablet.
Oh, it's so fantastic. Well, hey, I have kept you forever, but I like to end every single one of these episodes by asking my guest, what's the last thing that you ate that blew your mind?
The last thing I ate that blew my mind. Oh, God. Yeah, excellent. Let's lock a writer in a house for 2 years and then let me think. Well, you know, under duress, I mean, my wife and I, you know, we both cooked a lot prior to the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We've certainly had a lot of time to refine our approaches, believe you me. Oh, God. Honestly, it would probably be the last time my wife made pizza because it was the best iteration yet of her crust and the cheese sauce balance and just a steady process of getting everything right, because this is like iteration 30 of the pizza project. You know, it's a very quotidian answer for me, but like, you know, I haven't been going to a lot of, you know, like cutting edge Szechuan places in New York. You know, I haven't been hobnobbing with the jet set an awful lot lately.
What style of pizza?
I'm such a basic bitch when it comes to pizza. I am style agnostic. I like deep dish. I like flat. I like thin crust. I like New York style. I like Chicago style. I don't know what the hell Detroit style implies, but I would probably like it.
Oh, I love Detroit style. It's good stuff. It's like thick. It's like a thicker crust, but like a burnt cheese around the edge. Oh, it's really good.
Interesting. I'm not sure if I've ever consciously had that. I'm like a straightforward, you know, a relatively thinnish crust, double cheese pizza. Mm-hmm. Makes me very happy. Like I'm, like I said, I'm not terribly exciting. Sometimes, this sounds wild, but the combination is very good. Pineapple and banana pepper.
Oh.
And they've got to be together. You know, I don't put pineapple on pizza by itself, mm-hmm, or with anything except banana pepper. But when you put the two together, you get something really, really nice.
Ah, interesting.
I mean, other than that, I'm totally uninspired. And the thing is, I could eat cheese pizza 6 nights a week and just drive my wife to despair. I'm a fucking 17-year-old when it comes to cuisine. I mean, I could eat pizza and Subway for, you know, ever and just leave it at that. I'm very boring in that respect. But no, my wife forces me to have actual culinary taste and to cook a lot of stuff. And, you know, we do a lot of weird and interesting things with basic ingredients around here. So, you know, we do our best to not go crazy.
That was author Scott Lynch. Thanks so much to Scott for taking the time to chat. You can find links to Scott's website and social media down in the show notes. You can find me, as always, at brianmcclellan.com. Special thanks to James Sutter for music and Tom Bishop for production. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak or buy my books in ebook, paperback, or audio. Don't forget that my next epic fantasy, In the Shadow of Lightning, is now up for pre-order. You can also get signed copies of my books direct from my website or swag from my Redbubble store. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review. Huge thanks to Kyle Anderson, Patrick Hunt, Elijah, Jennifer and Angela Johnson, and Ivor Gullickson for their backing on Patreon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.